Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. If you are planning to go under the knife, as the expression goes, you will want to consider the research that tries to understand how anesthesia affects the brain. How anesthesia works is not fully understood, but it is apparent that quite a few seniors suffer from delirium after major surgery. Is this related to the anesthetic itself, a toxicity of some kind? Is it the surgery? Or does it speed up a cognitive decline that was going to happen anyway? All of these questions are looked at in the article, The Risk of Going Under, written by journalist Andrea Anderson and published in the March-April 2017 Scientific American Mind magazine. But let's start with an overview of anesthesia from Harvard Health Beat of May 2015. Many procedures require anesthesia, and which of the four types you have can affect your recovery. If you've ever had a tooth filled without Novocaine, you know the difference anesthesia can make. Anesthesia, whether it numbs your mouth or puts you into full sleep, is designed to keep you comfortable during a procedure that otherwise might be hard to tolerate physically, emotionally, or both. We have four goals: to see that you have no pain, that you're drowsy or unconscious, that your body is still so that the surgeon can work on it, and that you aren't left with bad memories of the procedure, says Dr. Kristen Schreiber, an anesthesiologist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. There are four basic kinds of anesthesia: local, which is typically administered to numb a small area; regional, which numbs a larger area, like your hand, arm, or foot; neuraxial, spinal or epidural, which is injected near the spine and numbs the lower half of your body; and general, which works in the brain to render you completely unconscious and unable to sense pain. The type used depends upon the procedure you're having, your state of health, and often your preferences. 1. Local anesthesia. Unless you've made it through life without having your wisdom teeth extracted or an injury that required stitches, you've probably had local anesthesia. Local anesthetics are injected near the area to be treated, and their effects are limited to a fairly small area. They are usually administered by a professional, a nurse, dentist, or doctor, who will make sure the area is numb. Giving local anesthesia actually does not require specialized training. Although you won't feel pain with a local, you may feel pressure. If you find that disturbing, you can be given a sedative to ease your anxiety. 2, regional anesthesia. In regional anesthesia, local anesthetics are injected near clusters of nerves to numb a larger area or region of the body. A classic example is hand surgery, where a shot of numbing medicine near the nerves in the armpit makes the whole arm go numb for 3 to 24 hours, depending on the type of numbing medicine used. 3, neuraxial anesthesia. Neuraxial anesthesia includes epidurals and spinals. In neuraxial anesthesia, numbing medicine is placed near the spinal roots, making an even larger part of the body numb than regional anesthesia does. Epidurals are commonly given to ease the pain of labor and childbirth or the pain with a large abdominal incision. Spinals, which block sensation to the abdomen and lower body, are frequently used for cesarean section and knee surgery. With both regional and neuraxial anesthesia, you may be able to choose how conscious you'll be during the procedure. With minimal sedation, you'll be relaxed but aware of what's going on. Moderate sedation will send you into a twilight sleep, in which you'll drift in and out of consciousness but can be easily aroused. With deep sedation, you are essentially fast asleep and unlikely to remember anything. 4, general anesthesia. Anesthesiologists use a combination of intravenous drugs that render you unconscious and unable to feel pain. You are also often given a drug to relax your muscles so that your body is still during the surgery. The anesthesiologist often inserts a tube in your trachea to allow him or her to help you breathe. Because general anesthesia affects so many body systems, it is associated with more side effects than regional anesthesia, including nausea and delirium, although these can be minimized. The effects of general anesthesia last longer in older people, it may take longer to restore memory, and they may have more delirium, Dr. Schreiber says. And we go now to The Risk of Going Under, written by Andrea Anderson. William Seiber was working in his garden, wasn't he? He was sure he'd been picking tomatoes just moments ago. Now he appeared to be in some kind of rehabilitation hospital. And weren't people looking at him a little strangely? What on earth were they up to? Seiber, a then 88-year-old retired pediatric surgeon, knew that something was not right. As he told his son Fritz a few months later, he was unable to shake the frightening fog of confusion and paranoia that enveloped him. This delirium lasted about a week. It had started after a fairly routine spinal surgery to relieve nerve pressure caused by stenosis, the narrowing of space around the spinal cord. The 45-minute procedure went according to plan. His anesthesiologist had sedated him using a typical cocktail of drugs. Before the operation, Seiber had not experienced any noticeable cognitive difficulties. He was living independently with his wife in a retirement community near Pittsburgh, still drove his own car, and read a book a week on his favorite topics, history and gardening. But his experience in recovery scared the daylights out of him, Fritz recalled. He knew that he was acting, in his words, crazy. He couldn't do anything about it, and that's what bothered him. It bothered his son, too. As director of anesthesiology at the Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center, Fritz took a professional interest. Not long after his father's 2007 surgery, he joined the ranks of researchers studying the impact of surgery and anesthesia on the brains of elderly patients. For decades, physicians have anecdotally reported mental changes, from short-term disorientation to outright dementia in older patients following surgery. Only more recently, though, have they begun to seriously investigate the prevalence of these changes, their duration, and an array of potential causes, mechanisms, and possible solutions. So far, these efforts have not turned up any definitive proof that anesthesia or surgery or both is directly responsible for post-surgical cognitive problems, but the circumstantial evidence is building. Several questions loom large. If the connection is real, is the main culprit consciousness-zapping drugs, the stress of surgery, or the brain inflammation that can accompany it? Are specific types of anesthesia more harmful than others? Are certain patients more susceptible to surgery-related cognitive decline? And perhaps most critical, are there ways to ward off any potential negative effects? To date, a few guideposts have emerged. Among them, the importance of offering counseling and evaluating patients' cognition before they get wheeled into the operating room, but definitive answers cannot come soon enough. Every year, more than 17 million seniors in the U.S. undergo surgery. With more than 75 million baby boomers hitting their golden years, the number of Americans facing hip replacements, heart repairs, and all manner of other procedures is sure to rise. Soon, many more seniors and their families will face tough decisions as they try to balance the best treatment options against potential risks to their cognition and quality of life. Researchers began exploring the potential cognitive effects of surgery and anesthesia in earnest in the 1990s, focusing largely on two outcomes: postoperative delirium, marked by temporary disorientation, hallucinations, and memory problems, and postoperative cognitive dysfunction. The latter, known as POCD, encompasses a range of lasting deficits, among them problems with learning, memory, attention, and abstract thinking. These studies suggested that postoperative delirium is remarkably common, occurring in up to half of patients older than 65, with even more patients displaying some milder confusion. They also found that POCD affected at least a third of elderly patients, although it has proved trickier to pinpoint because there is no standard way to measure or diagnose it. In 2001, a pivotal study in the New England Journal of Medicine documented even higher rates of delirium and POCD and an apparent overlap between the two. A Duke University-led team measured neurocognitive function in 261 patients, all older than 50, both before and after coronary artery bypass graft surgery. Among the tests they ran were some that measured how well these individuals remembered details from a story and a series of digits and shapes, as well as their speed at drawing lines through sequential numbers or letters. At discharge, typically a week after surgery, more than half of the participants showed at least a 20% drop in at least one of the cognitive areas tested. Many improved quickly. After 6 weeks, 36% still struggled. After 6 months, less than a quarter did. But for a significant number of these subjects, their cognitive problems persisted or reappeared. 5 years after surgery, 42% of the 172 patients who returned for testing exhibited signs of cognitive decline. In patients with cognitive decline at discharge, these losses were 2 to 3 times those seen among nearly 6,000 Medicare patients tracked for 5 years in a separate study. In the years since, a growing body of research has shown that seemingly temporary postoperative deficits can resurface months, even years, after surgery. We do know that patients having procedures in hospital have a very high rate of delirium, and we know that that puts patients at increased risk of cognitive decline down the track, says Lisbeth Everard, an anesthesia researcher at St. Vincent's Hospital, Melbourne, in Australia. Last year, investigators at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and elsewhere sought to quantify that risk. They tracked 560 individuals, all older than 70 and initially shown to be dementia-free, undergoing total hip replacement or another major surgery. They found that 134, or about 24%, experienced postoperative delirium. Compared with the participants who did not have delirium, those who did were significantly more likely to show mental deterioration years down the line. Although both groups on average experienced some cognitive decline, the rate was nearly 3 times faster in the group who had suffered from delirium. What is not clear, however, is if the decline is caused by the delirium or if the delirium is indicative of some underlying brain vulnerability or if something else entirely is to blame. Several months after Sieber's back surgery, he faced a knee operation. His spell of postoperative confusion had completely dissipated, but he still felt apprehensive. "I just can't have that happen to me again," he told his son. So Fritz asked his father's anesthesiologist to consider using a regional anesthetic, which can produce lighter sedation and might, he reasoned, have less of an effect on his father's thinking. She agreed, and the strategy paid off, although it is not always an option for longer surgeries. Sieber experienced no delirium and went home from the hospital after only 2 days, clear as a bell, Fritz remembers. "It really got me thinking about whether there are issues with drug dosing in the elderly." To try to find out, in 2010, Fritz and his colleagues evaluated delirium in 114 otherwise healthy elderly patients undergoing surgery for hip fractures. Instead of general anesthesia, the doctors administered varying doses of propofol via the spine. To estimate how deeply the patients went under, the researchers used a so-called bispectral index, BIS, monitor. The device gauges levels of consciousness based on the brain's electrical activity, measured with electrodes placed on the scalp. They found that after surgery, the patients who had been only lightly sedated as measured via BIS, regardless of how much anesthesia they received, experienced half the rate of postoperative delirium compared with the rest. In other words, sedation depth and not anesthetic dose had predicted whether or not someone experienced delirium. Other studies, however, do link anesthesia dose to delirium. In 2013, researchers at the Chinese University of Hong Kong evaluated 921 elderly patients undergoing major surgery, only some of whom received BIS monitoring to make sure they stayed minimally sedated. Compared with the group that was not monitored, BIS-monitored patients received on average 21% less propofol when it was administered intravenously and 30% less via inhalation. There were also more than 30% less likely to have postoperative delirium or to have POCD 3 months after discharge. The lower exposure to anesthesia may have been the crucial factor, says Duke anesthesiologist Miles Berger, who was not involved in the work. Complicating this picture, though, additional evidence hints that deep sedation may sometimes protect patients' brain function. In 2015, Mount Sinai Hospital anesthesiology, geriatrics, and palliative medicine researchers Stacy Diner and her colleagues reanalyzed BIS measurements from 105 older individuals undergoing major surgery with intravenous or inhaled general anesthesia. They found that patients who spent 50% more time in deep anesthetic states had lower POCD rates on average 3 months after surgery. Those who were deeply sedated for longer also displayed more burst suppression, a type of neural activity characterized by almost no brain function, punctuated by flurries of activity. Diner's team suspects that sustained periods of burst suppression brought on by deep sedation may shield the brain from trauma. Her study highlights a central question about whether anesthetics harm or protect the brain. This uncertainty persists in large part because researchers still do not fully understand how anesthetics work. In general, these drugs slow nerve firing throughout the brain. But as Imperial College London biophysics and anesthetics researcher Nick Franks explains, some also boost neural activity along the pathways that make us sleepy. On another level, research suggests that anesthetics disrupt the way in which neurotransmitters typically interact with their receptors. Many common anesthetics, including sevoflurane and propofol, bind to receptors that regulate memory, attention, and concentration, and may even rewire connections essential to these functions, according to researcher Laszlo Vuckitz of the University of Geneva. Animal studies consistently show that some general anesthetics injure neurons, alter the branch-like dendrites that allow nerve cells to communicate, and trigger learning problems. But they also show that other drugs may safeguard the brain from damage. It may be that an animal's age helps to determine the permanence of any neuronal changes. Vuckitz argues, for instance, that young developing brains are flexible enough to compensate for or reverse anesthesia-induced modifications. The likelihood that postoperative cognitive problems stem from more than one factor is one of the things that makes understanding human models so confusing, Diner says. Sieber recovered quickly from his second surgery, but started to show signs of dementia a few years later. His mental capacity continued to deteriorate until his death in 2015. Sieber's trajectory, cognitive difficulties that emerge after surgery, then dissipate and ultimately return, matches that of many patients. Given the slew of unanswered questions concerning anesthesia, his son, like many other experts, began to consider factors such as surgery itself and a presumed consequence, neuroinflammation. Inflammation is our body's natural response to a trauma. Immune cells release chemicals to help heal damage, keep intruders at bay, and protect us from further harm. But sometimes this defense mechanism goes awry, launching a full-fledged war when only a small surge is warranted. Many investigators now believe that surgery can trigger brain inflammation, which in turn produces cognitive problems. You get an inflammatory insult as a result of the surgery that is then redirected at the brain, says anesthesia researcher Roderick Eckenhoff of the University of Pennsylvania. A series of studies have shown that rodents display robust inflammatory responses to surgery, which increase their risk of POCD-related brain damage. In 2016, one mouse study found that surgery triggered inflammation in the brain's memory center, which impaired the animal's power to recall a familiar mouse, among other tests. In contrast, when the animals received just anesthesia without surgery, they showed no memory problems. The same study reported that mice that were engineered to lack a normal inflammatory response or that received an anti-inflammatory drug during surgery could also sidestep these cognitive costs. Unfortunately, the findings are less straightforward in humans. If, for instance, neuroinflammation leads to cognitive issues, then brief, relatively non-invasive surgeries should probably be less risky. But in a 2015 pilot study, Chief of Geriatrics Cynthia X. Pan and her colleagues at New York Presbyterian Queen's Hospital compared mental outcomes in dozens of older individuals undergoing either laparoscopic colon surgery involving small incisions or more invasive colon surgery. They found that almost half of all patients experienced POCD, and its occurrence in both groups was essentially the same. Also confounding was a Chinese study in which investigators randomly assigned elderly knee surgery patients to receive either paracoxib, an anti-inflammatory drug, or saline with general anesthesia. They found that the paracoxib group exhibited fewer inflammatory markers and half the rate of POCD 1 week after surgery. 3 months out, that gap closed, casting doubt on how much inflammation harms cognition in the long run. Other research implicates ailments such as chronic heart disease, hypertension, and Alzheimer's disease, which is associated with neuroinflammation. In people with these conditions who are already more susceptible to cognitive decline, triggering additional inflammation with surgery or drugs may hasten an ongoing process. In 2013, Eckenhoff and his colleagues at the University of Pennsylvania explored this idea, studying the effects of surgery and anesthesia on normal mice versus mice genetically engineered to develop Alzheimer's-like dementia. They found that surgery led to dramatic learning and memory problems in the genetically altered mice. But surgery in the normal mice and anesthesia in both groups had no significant impact on cognition. Last year, Katie J. Schenning and her colleagues at Oregon Health and Science University retrospectively analyzed data from two studies and compared 182 elderly individuals who had one or more surgeries under general anesthesia with 345 of their peers who had never had surgery or had at least avoided general anesthesia. They found that the group who received general anesthesia displayed significantly worse cognitive abilities over the course of 7 years on average and showed brain shrinkage and ventricular enlargement, an expanding of brain cavities that is associated with dementia. These changes were most pronounced among surgical patients who carried the APOE4 allele, a gene variant that increases the risk of developing Alzheimer's. Perhaps the people most affected are already at risk for having this cognitive decline, and perhaps are already declining, says Schenning, an anesthesiology and perioperative medicine researcher. Maybe it's gone unrecognized until they have a major life stress, such as surgery, that sort of pushes them over the cliff. Did Sieber's surgeries ultimately contribute to his dementia? His son cannot rule out the possibility that his father was always at risk and would have deteriorated anyway. Part of the issue with older adults is that what you're observing is part of a longer trajectory of decline, Diener says. So understanding whether the person is having just normal age-related changes versus having an actual problem related to surgery and anesthesia can be a bit thorny to figure out. Whatever the cause, cognitive problems post-surgery present serious challenges to patients and their families. Esther Oh, co-director of the Johns Hopkins Memory and Alzheimer's Treatment Center, describes one all too common scenario. An elderly person has routine surgery and winds up either dependent on family members or needing an assisted living facility. Before that happens, experts are recommending several strategies that may help reduce the risk of post-surgical delirium and POCD. First, elderly patients and their families should be advised of possible risks in a frank manner and be made aware of any non-surgical options. For those facing surgery, Siebert advocates preoperative screening for subtle cognitive impairment. Those who show signs of cognitive change would benefit from adhering to evidence-based guidelines, such as enhanced recovery after surgery, which aim to decrease surgical complications through counseling, to reduce physiological stress, and to standardize anesthetic protocols, such as using lower doses or less sedation. Even simple tactics, such as making sure older patients always have their glasses or hearing aids at their bedside, can help reduce disorientation. Similarly, patients may feel less disconcerted if they are allowed to wake up on their own in recovery rather than being roused. Investigators emphasize that the possible links among surgery, anesthesia, POCD, and dementia should not scare anyone away from procedures that can improve health or quality of life. Instead, they want to maximize patient outcomes. It is not acceptable to say, "Grandma was never quite right after surgery," says Beverly Orser, an anesthesia researcher at the University of Toronto. Survival's not good enough. We want them to thrive. We have time briefly to look at levels of consciousness, the bispectral index. So between 80 and 100 on the index, you are awake and fully alert. Between 60 and 80, light moderate sedation, where you remain somewhat responsive to loud voices and physical prodding. 40 to 60 is general anesthesia. You're unconscious, unresponsive to most outside stimuli. 20 to 40, deep hypnotic state, completely sedated, no awareness. 0 to 20, burst suppression, mostly no brain function, punctuated by flurries of activity. And of course, we go to the flatline EEG, where there is no neural activity. And on that note, I say thank you for tuning in to Sound Body. Stay well and come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.